So I put all of that energy into that one tournament, and I was like, okay, like I can do it. I can do this. And then once the tour started and things started to get real again, it was like, no, this is not going to work at all.
Welcome to Patent Pending, a show about the future of disc golf. I'm Jesse from Trash Panda, and on the show today, how Brian Earhart overcame all odds to make a career out of the sport he loves. I think we can all agree on one thing. There's just something about the way a disc flies. From watching someone else throw to visualizing and executing your own perfect shot, nothing compares to the unique flight of a disc. And while we all love the flying disc, our guest on the show today may just love it more than the rest of us combined. In a time before disc golf was a viable career path, Brian Earhart vividly remembers his early days falling in love with disc golf and trying to plan a career around it. Sure, there was the competition, and of course the sponsorships, but Brian's desire for a disc-centric career went much deeper. Today, you may know him as a podcaster, commentator, and disc golf personality, but as a 13-year-old kid, it wasn't the frisbee that caught his attention. Nope, it all started with a bowling ball and the experience of bowling the elusive 300.
It was a very special memory for me, actually. I don't know why. I mean, it wasn't like I was reading bowling books or watching pro bowling all the time. It was just all my friends were there. I had such good friends bowling, and my whole family did it, and I was pretty good at it, and it just made me feel really good. And the 300 was when I was 13. I have the ring that has the emerald in it, and it has like January 4th, 2004 or something engraved in it. I thought I was crazy when I was like 20 something trying to remember how old I was. I was like, there's no way I was 13 years old. And I was. And I had a couple weeks like in that time when I was bowling, and I was bowling so well. And I remember bowling a 289 in practice, 279. And then, yeah, I go to my, I think it was either Friday or Saturday league, and I hit like the first six. And I talk about this in commentary all the time now because I know the feeling of when you birdie a bunch of holes and you wake up and you're like, oh, I've birdied a bunch of holes. It's hard to like keep that going once you wake up. So
dang.
I'll never forget. I woke up at about the sixth strike, which is halfway through. And I was like, oh boy. I was like, okay, we're going to do this again, huh? And do you know what a Brooklyn strike is?
No.
So if you put hook on the ball and you're a righty, the strong side, same as disc golf, the strong side of the head pin is that right side. You're hooking into it. That's where you get the best pin action. But if you miss and you move left of the center pin, you're like fading away and you get a strike that way. It's called a Brooklyn strike. And it's like, it's not a good, it's like hitting a putt weak side. Literally. You're like, oh, thank God that stuck.
Huh.
I hit a Brooklyn strike on like my seventh frame, and I was like sweating, like, oh boy, now my hand's numb.
Whoa.
You know, people are starting to know. This was back when bowling, at least in my area, all 40 lanes were taken up by bowlers. So there was like hundreds of people in this bowling alley, and people started to, oh, Brian's got seven or eight in a row. I think eighth or ninth frame come. I hit another Brooklyn strike. I misthrow it again. I strike again. Everyone's going nuts. And then after a certain point, people just leave you alone. Like you just, They let you marinate in the stress of knowing that you have to wait for five more people or whatever to throw again. And then I got to the 10th. I think I hit another Brooklyn. I misthrew it again, and I got another strike. It was just one of those days. And then I closed it out, and my friend Chris was like standing right behind me, and I turned around, and his arms were wide open, and all these people were cheering. And I was this like chubby little 13-year-old with acne all over my face, and I was like so excited to have a whole room of people just loving me. And it felt so good. And I jumped into his arms, and yeah, I'll never forget it. We went to IHOP afterwards.
As but one does.
You know what, man? I don't even know. I feel like I wasn't even bowling to do that. I bowled because I loved being around all those people, but it wasn't like I was like, oh, I'm going to bowl 300 one day. I just liked bowling. And then later on, it got too serious for me because I started joining teams. Coaches wanted to start giving me lessons, and instantly got burnt out and just stopped wanting to do it. And I'll never forget that feeling of being in a bowling lesson when I was, I don't know, 14 years old, about to bowl in high school or something like that, and being like, what is this? Like, this is so stupid. Like, this is not why I come here. Having this guy tell me what to do. Funny enough, I'm a disc golf teacher now, but I keep that experience in mind. Long story long, I suppose. That's what it feels like.
It almost seems like
your
experience with bowling, for some who maybe know your story, would say it's almost foreshadowing where we might be going here. But before we get there, let's maybe go back. Is it 3 years? You're 10, you're in PE, there's an aerobie. Yeah. Mr. Tossie, is it?
Mr. Tossie, fifth grade PE.
Which is a crazy name, for considering there's a Frisbee now with that name on it too.
Yes.
Yeah, take us there.
I don't remember how I did. I just remember being so upset when the teacher called us in, because I was so hooked on this thing, just exploring it, because I had never, you know, done something like that other than playing with the toy in my garage. And it definitely intrigued me. But after that, I just played a bunch of Frisbee with my black Whammo Master in my garage, whether it was windy, and I would try to practice little MTA throws before I even knew that was a thing. I had a big imagination, and I started making up games with myself. I thought I invented Ultimate in my head. Like, it was a little bit different than Ultimate, but I had a whole sports league made up in my head with different characters. One guy threw only backhand, one guy only threw forehand. And I thought that I was inventing this game, and I was telling my friends in the neighborhood about it. And my mom, actually, I forgot if it was exactly that time or a little later or earlier, but she would tape number signs and put them around the neighborhood, and we would play Frisbee golf that way. Wow. You know, and I loved it. I just loved it so much. And ever since then, that's been the thing that's enamored me the most out of anything.
Wow. It's interesting you said it wasn't about the score right after talking about bowling, how it wasn't about the score. Mm-hmm. It was just about watching the flight of a disc and doing, something where you can, no pun intended, level up, right? Yeah. Something where you can improve, something where you can actually do well. Mm-hmm. So there was an achievement level to it.
Yeah.
But maybe, would you say growing up, were you competitive?
I don't know. I actually don't know. I was put into all the sports. You know, I played the basketball, I played the baseball, I played Little League, tried out for the travel teams. I was gutted when I didn't make a travel team 1 year. And then I got into volleyball, was the main game that I really fell in love with. Chicagoland area. It might be the same in Denver, but Chicagoland, a lot of really top level athletes play volleyball in the spring and forego baseball or track or whatever.
Interesting.
A lot of basketball players will cross over and play that in the springtime. And then, you know, myself and a lot of my best friends that I'm still friends with today, we played volleyball all year round. We played club volleyball. We traveled. We played the beach volleyball in the summertime. I loved it. But again, like you said, it just wasn't something that I cared about. Like when I would hit the volleyball, I would not try to strategically score points. I would try to do cool stuff. And it was bad. It was not smart. It was not good. But looking back, it wasn't I'm not reading the blockers on the other side. I'm not going this guy's tendency is to hang wide. I'm going to turn and go down the line with this one. Yada, yada, yada. My brain was just not thinking about that whatsoever.
Was disc golf just subtly in the background this whole time? What was your relationship with disc golf during those high school years?
Good question. I was grinding. I was grinding disc golf. But again, no one in my school played it. All of my closest friends played volleyball. So I would always go to the field across from my house, and I would do field work, you know, by myself.
Interesting.
And I would throw by myself. And especially when I was in junior high and I first got really into it, I was just experimentation, going across the street, chucking forehands, trying to learn backhand from any local I could find at the course. And then in high school, eventually I found that community. I found my real disc golf friends when I started playing leagues for the first time. And then things kind of took off from there. I had people that were old enough to drive me places. You know, I started playing some tournaments.
At some point in there, I remember you saying that you had this feeling of I need to make the flying disc my life. Mm-hmm. I need to get a career that works around the flying disc. Mm-hmm. Where did that come to play? And what was that like for you? By the way, we should mention, this is before many people are making a career out of Frisbees.
Oh, yeah.
And that's kind of unheard of at this point.
Yes, and I knew that. And, you know, I had parents that didn't know a lick about this game, and they thought I was goofy for even playing it. You know, they called me the king of obscure sports growing up. They both predicted that I would be a game show host when I grew up. Funny enough, I just won that Jeopardy game on GK, and I was like, I could host one of these, and my parents thought it was the funniest thing.
Destiny.
Yeah, because their prophecy could potentially come true, but it was just that little voice in the back of your head. And some people have it for certain things and some people don't. And I did. And growing up, I kind of had this plan. When I was getting late in high school, I was going to go to college. I was going to go play Ultimate Frisbee in college because I looked it up and there was really no disc golf club or team at, you know, at my college, which was Illinois State University.
Yeah, you're super unique in that you went from disc golf to ultimate. That's the reverse of the story that most people experience.
Yeah, yeah. But it actually was, it was great. It was very humbling for me because I could smash the disc. My touch was just abysmal. So I went into college all cocky. Yeah, I got learned, so to speak. But my plan was I was going to go to school. I loved working with kids. I had worked in summer camps. That was like the big job that I had every summer. I'm going to go to college. I'm going to get a PE teaching degree. I'm going to teach elementary school PE, work with those goofy kids, you know, forever. And then in the summers, I'm going to tour for disc golf. I had this big plan. So then it's no pressure. I get to college and my mental health went off the deep end for a few reasons. It went real bad to the point where I almost dropped out and some really nasty things went on in my head around junior year. So career-wise in disc golf was starting to feel very grim for me. I was starting to get really pessimistic. I knew that this was the thing that I thought about all the time. You know, ultimate was fun. It kept me like outside and it kept me with people and it kept me from isolating myself. But I was not well when I was playing and disc golf was really the one thing that I thought about all the time. But during that time, I was like, I am never going to be good enough to make it. I was playing all the time, but I just never thought I was going to be good enough. Just watching videos of like Will Schustrick and those guys, like, I just never thought I would get there. And then also I was like looking up all these, you know, stats and looking up how much money they made and it didn't look like it was a lot. And I was like, well, crap, what do I do now? You know, this, I'm getting towards the end of college. What the heck? So I pretty much hit rock bottom with my mental health my junior year. And coincidentally, I needed to get an internship for my degree. So I was pretty much waiting to the last minute because I almost never went to class that year. And again, I nearly dropped out. Because I couldn't even leave my room for a lot of the year. But I eventually had one of those shining moments of motivation. And I always say, like, if you're depressed, you have to milk that one moment so hard because so many good things can happen in that little period of time. And I did. And I emailed the PDGA and I asked them about internships. And they were like, no, we don't really do that, but we can. And I got an internship with them and I got to kind of escape Illinois and escape where I was and escape all the bad feelings that I had towards the place. And I got to go to Georgia and I worked for them for a summer and where I would say not everything was fixed, but it definitely opened my eyes to a lot that was out there.
Hmm. Was it game over at that moment for everything other than the flying disc in your life? Was it just like, this is it?
Yeah. Yeah, it was. It was, but I didn't know how to do it because again,
you weren't there yet. So you wasn't good enough.
Yeah. I was not good enough at the time when I interned with them. I was like 960 rated and I had like a kooky play style. I was like all sidearm for touch shots and flip ups and backhand only for distance and like speed and hyzers. So it was just a weird, like poor man's righty play style. So I was still kind of like, I don't know how I'm going to do this. So in the back of my head, being a player was still a thing, but I still had to like figure out how to do it. And then I get done with the internship, go back to school. I finish up ultimate and I go down the path of least resistance. I take the lowest hanging fruit job that I could. And I learned so many valuable lessons doing that. And I think that job that I took right away out of school, it was really not a good situation. That was the one point where I realized this cannot happen. I need to like formulate a plan to get out there and be with the disc golf tour. And I need to figure this out because this is literally all I'm thinking about when I'm sitting at work.
Yeah.
So I quit that job after like 7 weeks and I formulate a plan to...
By the way, whether people realize it or not, this is probably the eighth time you've said the word plan. People know you as a commentator now. Yeah. They know your podcast. They know you as a player, as a coach. I mean, you are clearly an analytical person. And obviously you internalize that for your life too.
Yeah.
So plan is key. So what happens in that moment when you decide, okay, I'm making a plan?
The plan essentially was, I am going to use my disc golf resources to find a better paying job. I don't know what the heck it is. I'll do anything as long as it pays well. And I have a purpose for why I'm making this money. So I found a job through one of my best disc golf friends, Roman, who was a QA guy for a tech startup, which happened to be 15 minutes away from my parents' house. I told my parents about what I'm doing. I told them that I'm going to come home, get this job, save money, and go on tour. And they still thought I was a little nuts because they still didn't know what the heck touring meant. But they said, sure, if you have a plan, like we're okay with that. If you go 100% into this, we're cool with that.
So Brian made a plan. Now armed with a purpose, a better paying job with the perfect field for lunchtime fieldwork nearby, and a steady supply of meal replacement shakes, Brian executed his game plan to the T. But little did he know, adversity was waiting just around the corner. Stay with us, we'll be right back with Brian Earhart. Thanks so much for listening to the show this week. Disc golf content is what Jomez Pro does best, and in large part, it's due to the support from fans like you. So this season, as a patent-pending listener, you can save 20% on your next purchase from the Jomez Pro store by using the code PATPEND20 at checkout. That's all caps, PATPEND, and the number 20. This code will be live for all of 2023, can only be used once per customer, and can't be combined with any other coupon codes or used to purchase gift cards. So consider helping support the show today while saving big at jomezpro.com with code PATPEN20. We truly appreciate your support. Welcome back to the show. It's 2018 and Brian is now officially a touring pro living out his dream. But right away, everything changed. From injury to competitive pressure to sustaining a life on the road, Brian's story is one of perseverance and commitment. It's one of overcoming adversity and one of finding happiness in surprising places. As it turned out, the role of touring pro would become much more of a bridge than a destination. But if you're thinking of one of those nice, strong, beautiful bridges, think again. Right from the start, it was more like one of those swaying bridges over a rushing river where every other plank is missing. And not only that, but the very first plank he stepped on broke.
I got brutally injured. My rotator cuff got totally messed up like two or three tournaments into my tour that I had saved money for like 2.5 years for pretty aggressively. And that changed everything for me, honestly. Right from the get-go, it was like, oh, okay. Overuse injuries are a thing. And I had like played this game since I was a child. So I never thought of like training for the game like Ezra Aderholt trains for the game. My brain just said, go play Frisbee. Looking back, it was just really foolish to try to practice 8 hours a day like I was. But I had the freedom to go do it. I had finally achieved this thing that I had worked for so long. And I had made it out on the road. But instantly it was like I was up against the wall and I was like, crap, I'm literally the same age as Paul McBeth. I'm not like 16 years old. I have to catch up to this guy who is the greatest that's ever played now. So what do I do? My shoulder doesn't even work and it's been three tournaments. So that right there put me in a space where I was really having to think about my career on the road and how I was going to stay out here. And pretty much I had to tell my story, why I was here, how I got out here. Answer the questions that I was getting from all sorts of people in my life. Like, why are you doing this? So I started blogging. I think the Bearheart, it was like bearheartblog.com or something. I wrote like, you know, 5 to 10 blog posts that ended up getting quite a bit of traction. I ended up getting some article gigs from UDisc because of it, or UltiWorld or something. And that was kind of my first start of media, was writing and sharing my story with people. And that's when all of that kind of stuff started, because I got traction very quickly when I was doing stuff like that. It was like crazy how once you open up to other people, other people open up to you. Yeah. And that's when I realized, oh, this storytelling thing and this writing thing is really enjoyable for me. And then I wrote those two instructional articles for UltiWorld pretty quickly after that. And that's when I started getting a lot of traction of people wanting to send me form videos. And that's when the coaching really ramped up. I had actually done, when I got sponsored by Discraft, I was doing free form videos all year. That was like a thing that I did try to get traction before I toured. Yeah. And it worked almost too well. That is what got me my first taste. And then fast forward, I get all the, you know, from this, I meet Yuli. Yuli likes the way that I talk about disc golf. Yuli wants me to help teach clinics with him in 2019. So he takes me under his wing. We tour together until he rips his ACL. You know, when he did that, we had recorded two episodes of that podcast, The Buzz. That was like our first project. So Big Germ and Yuli were two guys that were so fundamental in getting me out there to the disc golf world and saying, hey, this guy has something to say and it's kind of interesting. Please listen to him. And that was a huge springboard for me, was those guys and meeting them and talking Frisbee with them and getting them excited. I had like a 2.5 hour conversation with Yuli the first night I met him about the Banger GT and how he thought it was the greatest putter in the world at the time and how it was going to fix this weird form thing he had going on. Yeah. And I just so happened to putt with Bangers. So that was like another weird thing that we had. But those guys got me where I needed to be. And that's when I started doing Jomez. So I did the 2019 Texas State Championships for Jomez with Yuli after I like freak accident broke my foot right before Waco. So yeah, we won't even go into that. But I started getting commentary gigs because of that, because I needed money. And I was like messaging people. And
not to interrupt you here, but like you make this plan to go on tour.
Yeah.
You get injured. You make this plan to do this podcast with Yuli. He gets injured.
Yeah.
It's just the plans keep getting derailed.
Of course. And well, I bought an RV before I went on tour and I got totally hosed on that. And I spent $9,500 on nothing. So I went from like living in an RV to like living out of my Buick like a week before I was about to leave for tour. So I was already used to getting my plans crapped on. I'm the kind of guy who likes to dump the Legos out and start building rather than looking at the instructions ahead of time. That's like the kind of guy I am.
And then start rebuilding as soon as it falls over.
You just got to keep going.
Rebuilding, you keep going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, yeah, he gets injured. And I was like, well, I'll just interview my friends because I was finally starting to make some friends on tour. And I was like, well, I'll let them tell their story of why they're doing this and how they got to do this. And it turned out to be so fruitful for me. And I learned so much about these people and their resilience. And I learned so many life lessons from these people. I could write a book right now about everything that I've learned from all these people. And I think I've only done like 30 or 40 episodes.
The blog and then The Buzz, which became Flight Diary, and then some commentary gigs becoming actual full-blown commentary for a full season with Gatekeeper. I mean, that's when we start to see a bunch of Reddit posts that are like, oh my goodness, Brian Earhart is great at commentary. Yeah. Hello, Brian Earhart, where have you been with commentary? And so we're seeing all this. All the while, you're still playing professionally.
Trying. I was trying, yeah. Yeah.
Take us there.
I mean, again, my whole class of players like that started touring around the same time, like Nate Perkins, Eric Oakley, Luke Humphreys. I mean, there's probably numerous other ones from that class that were kind of in the same boat where we were like, okay, well, we have to make money. And it wasn't like players were getting amazing contracts right away. So we had to do a little media to like supplement us trying to stay out here on the road to get as good as Paul McBeth to make the real money, because the big contracts didn't start coming until maybe a year or two later. So, you know, I was doing little bits and pieces of gigs for people. I did some stuff for GK. I did some stuff for Gatekeeper, Jomez. Gatekeeper was actually my first commentary gig in 2018. I did the Delaware Disc Golf Challenge at Iron Hill with Joel Freeman. So that was my first gig ever. And then Jomez was the one that really set me forward. And then I started getting calls from a few different places. But Gatekeeper hit me up at, I believe, the end of 2020. Or the end of 2019, they said, hey, like, we want you to be like our guy. And I was like, yeah, 100%. Let's do it. We did it. And it was like a lot of work. And I helped with a lot of the audio. I used my podcast setup and I took the videos from them and I recorded the audio, laid it over, sent it back to them, you know, and I did that every morning before I was about to play. And
to go back out. Wow.
It was hard. It was really hard. And it was really frustrating, actually. It was too much. to be honest. It was way too much, but I don't regret doing it at all.
You've referred to this time in your life as maybe the bridge.
Yeah.
Leading to something else. Mm-hmm. It sounds like all of this is just 2020, 2021. We're starting to just converge.
Yeah.
Do you remember a moment in 2020 or in 2021? Do you remember like any particular places you were? I'm almost going sensory here. Do you remember anything from that in which you were like, this maybe isn't working, or something else needs to happen, or there's somewhere else for me?
Yes. 2020 just was the most stressful year. It wasn't really lockdown. The disc golf season was stressful. Lockdown was a dream come true. Discraft takes great care of their players, and we did just fine during lockdown. So it was a real stress relief for us, actually. We got to finish our van. I got to record some podcasts with Michael Johansson because I was in Charlotte for lockdown. You know, some of my favorite memories are from that lockdown, actually. But once the season started back up, it just, it was too much. The commentary, playing, it's just everything was like 50% good rather than one thing being 100% good. And I was struggling. I don't know. It was just, it was too much. So then I went into the 2020, you know, off season, and I was like, okay, I am going to go to a place where I can practice every day as hard as I can to give this one last try. Can I be an elite player, like elite player, and do the podcast and do commentary, and just, I'm going to just play less tournaments, and I'm just going to play solid quality tournaments, and I'm going to try to make this all happen. So I train. My game is to a great spot. We rebrand the podcast into the Flight Diary. My buddy, Matt Siebert, who designed my Bearheart logo, did all that logo package and everything. So we're ready to rumble. We're ready to do it. I go out to Vegas. I get seventh place or sixth place in Vegas. I shoot great golf. I'm feeling great. People are starting to talk about me as a player. I shot like 13 down one of the rounds. It was like one of my best rounds ever. And I was like on top of the world. I handled it. I got up at 5 a.m. I did the commentary. I even had time to like read and meditate before I did my commentary. I was in such a good place. But that was because I had 3 months of rest.
The whole off season.
So I put all of that energy into that one tournament. And I was like, okay, like I can do it. I can do this. And then once the tour started and things started to get real again, it was like, no, this is not going to work at all. I started getting so overwhelmed, so stressed. And again, like the podcast was starting to like blow up a little bit. And I started feeling like this insane pressure to like keep going with it. But I didn't have any space for it whatsoever. So I started feeling really bad because we started taking on patrons and people were like paying me to make this podcast happen. And I just like couldn't. I mean, we delivered that year. I think we put out like, you know, a solid amount of episodes, but it was like, still, to my standards, it was not enough. And I felt like I was doing okay with the commentary, but it was making my play significantly worse. And then I don't know if it was stress related or was just straight up overuse again, but I got injured, and this was a new injury, and it didn't go away. And it was my back. And I've seen some really nasty comments on Reddit about me dropping out of tournaments that season because of my back. I would try to go play. I'd put a bunch of Tiger Balm on it. I'd take a bunch of ibuprofen and I would try to go play the tournament. And I would be like paralyzed with pain after the first round and I would drop. And I think I did that 3 or 4 times that season, which apparently people care about, which is strange, but it was just a tough year in that regard for me. So just many things were not working. And I knew in that moment that I was going to have to pick. And I had turned 30. I was like, okay, Paul is literally still the same age as me. That hasn't changed. And he's the benchmark of what I'm going to have to match if I want to be sustainable as an athlete in this game. There's no retirement plan if you're 10-20 rated in the game. You're going to play until you're dead or you find another option. And I didn't want to do that. And I didn't want to bet on myself anymore as a player. And I was like, realistically, I'm getting very good praise for this media stuff. I think if I stopped playing and the overarching stress of constantly worrying about how much you're sleeping, how much you're eating, how much water you're drinking, how much you're stretching, you know, the stress was so overbearing for me that the moment it was gone, it was like, oh, media is the easiest thing ever now. This is amazing. So in that moment, it was after I think Waco or the tournament after that, 2021, I started realizing like, this is not going to happen. And then at Jonesboro, that's when I was like, done. I was like, okay, we're making the decision. You know, Lindsay was like questioning. She was like, do you think this is the right idea? And I was like, I know this is the right idea. I know the moment I express to the world that I'm going to do this, because this is the first time a player has done this, I'm going to get calls from everybody. I know it. And I'm going to bet on myself in that regard, because I'm confident that I'm good enough to do that. The moment it happened, you know, I tapped out USDGC 2021. AJ Risley gave me a big hug. I thought it was going to be emotional, but it was the most relieving thing of my entire life. I was so happy, so happy. And I don't know. I think for a long time when I was really like low on myself, I claimed that I hated people, but I think it was because I loved them so much. And I wanted their approval and I wanted the love of other people so badly that it scared me. And it was easier as like an early 20s, late teens to say I hated everybody. Everyone sucks. Mm-hmm. Everyone is foolish and stupid and selfish and blah, 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 blah. All the stuff that an angsty young adult says. But really, yes. I love people so much and I care about people so much and I care about the people in the disc golf community so much because I've heard the stories from these people. I've heard what disc golf has done for them as well as myself. You talk to the old heads that are so proud of where disc golf is now, and they watch the live coverage with no judgment because they know that back when they were playing, there was no live coverage. So they're just so grateful that everything is happening the way it is because they lit the torch all those years ago. So for me, it's the easiest thing in the world to now be in a place where I can evangelize this game that I love so much, because I think that's more what I'm meant to do. I mean, I loved playing, but you interview people like Kristen Tatar, you interview people like Paul McBeth, Ricky Wysocki. It is not about these like little delicate dances of the disc. It is like A to B, win, 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 win. That is their obsession. And I'm not like that. I don't need to do that. And that's never going to bode well as a career. Like, do I like competing? Yeah, it's fun every now and then. You know, I enjoyed the skins match I played on GK. It was fun.
It's very clear that you are someone who reflects on yourself as an individual. And from afar, it's very clear that you love people as well. And you love our sport.
Yeah.
As far as like, you have undergone a massive shift in your relationship with the sport.
Mm-hmm.
Because early on, it was, even though competing wasn't maybe the thing that you fell in love with, it was about that. That was the way to make a career. Intentionally broad, what is disc golf to you now?
It's everything. It's the clothing that I put on every single morning. That's the closest thing that I can say. You know, I think when I was competing, it felt like I was putting on a costume. I'd put it on and then I'd go out there and I would do the thing and I would compete and I would smile, but then I would take it off at the end of the day. And I just didn't believe that that was me. But the moment I maybe just moved forward in my life as a person and then started making choices to align my beliefs and my actions more, AKA what I did last year with the media shift. Now it feels like a t-shirt. Now it feels like what I put on every morning and it's just comfortable. That's what disc golf is to me. It is every corner of my being. Not necessarily I'm some like geeky frisbee, like run on the, you know, news and hold up a poster that says play disc golf. That's not me, but I am a product of the history of frisbee. And, you know, I try to remember how those people first felt when they picked up a Pluto platter for the first time, or a cherry can lid, or a pie pan. And they threw it and they were filled with wonder and they decided to make up games because of it. And that's what it is to me. It's culture. And we are a part of that culture. And I've always said it's a goal of mine to take this thing that we love so much and take it from counterculture and inject it into our culture as Americans. And it's funny because it's starting to happen. And because of it, we're starting to deal with some really uncomfortable things that our mainstream culture has to deal with. So you get what you ask for, but it's happening. That's what disc golf is to me. It's way bigger than the sport. It's way bigger than, you know, throwing a frisbee anymore. This is American culture. This is history. This is a really cool part of our history of our country. Plastic being made in like the 1930s, 40s. 50s. That toy became what it was because of that. And because people on ranches in Texas in the 1920s were throwing the lids on lard cans, you know, and making up games with that. And all over the country, all these people were throwing different lids, cookie tins, cherry cans, and making up games. And then eventually they all came to Victor Belafonte, who was doing research on this, and realized how cool this little thing is that we have. And fast forward, you know, the old Frisbees used to say, play catch, invent games. And now here we are. We've invented some pretty cool games. And now we are sharing them with everybody. And it's awesome. You're at the Portland Open last year, or this year even. There's like 2,500 people, and they are so excited to be there because of this little flying thing that we have that we all love doing. So again, long story long, that's what it is to me. And I could talk about this all day. I'm actually writing a book about it, but that's probably not going to come out for, you know, a while. This is going to be my little ode to the sport. That's not going to come out for a while, but as you can tell, it means a lot to me.
Absolutely. If you had a platform to speak to anyone who maybe was Brian Earhart, you know, back in high school, college, early years of disc golf, someone who is looking at disc golf and wanting to make a career out of the sport, what would you say to that person?
Okay, well, if it was me, I would say don't change a thing, because I am truly the happiest that I've ever been. You know, and again, happiness is not like the day-to-day, like shining glory, you know, happy all the time thing. I think joy is often confused with happiness, but I feel like I've encompassed that idea of happiness, of like just earnestly trying and being an earnest person every day, trying to be better, trying to make other people's lives better, and trying to contribute in any way that I can. So no, I'm not changing a thing if I had to talk to my younger self. I went through some tough times, but they taught me a lot.
Got you where you are.
We can't butterfly effect that. But if it's somebody else, you have to tell your story. I don't care what it is, if you make grilled cheeses or you knit or you play Frisbee, you have to convince people that what you have to say has meaning. And that means you have to convince them that you're earnest and that you care. And that's what I would tell any young person, because these days you can make a living in anything, but you have to be a good storyteller and you have to be captivating in a way.
That's Brian Earhart, podcaster, content creator, and commenter extraordinaire. You can find him on Instagram at Brian_Earhart. And if you like this episode, I highly recommend checking out his Level Up series on the Discraft YouTube channel, as well as his podcast, The Flight Diary, which, if you like stories, is an absolute goldmine. In fact, on his show, he always makes sure to ask his guests one question, so I couldn't help but turn the tables before I let him go. I just have to ask, what is the shot that fascinates you the most? The shot that, when you look at it, is still just surprising to you?
You asked me the question that I love asking people. There's a couple that I really love. The one that always gets me is the double flex. That is a shot when you throw it off elevation and it's in the air long enough to where it like it flexes and then it, you know, continues fading out, but then it picks up speed and then it does it again.
It does it again. Yeah.
That is one of the coolest things that I've ever seen.
Physics in action.
Yes.
Like, what is happening?
Mind-boggling stuff in action. The other one is when you get a disc beat to a specific wear where you can get the tiniest little late flip out of it, where it's like 90% through the flight and then it finally ticks over and turns with the spin. Comets do that really well. So I love a good intentional late flip. Like, literally you feel like a wizard when you throw the shot.
Yeah.
It's just absolute beauty.
Thanks so much for listening to the show this week. Patent Pending is presented by Jomez Pro, and you can subscribe anywhere you listen to podcasts. If you want to follow us on Instagram for more consistent updates, we are at Patent Pending Show. And if you want to contact the team, our email address is patentpendingshow@jomezpro.com. This episode was produced by Andy Padula with music composed by Starframe. I'm Jesse from Trash Panda, and you've been listening to Patent Pending.